This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to a scientist who says a whopping 14% of the world's tree species have yet to be discovered. Now, the U.S. Department of Labor released its latest jobs numbers last week. They blew past what many economists were expecting. The U.S. added nearly 467,000 jobs in January, a figure that's seasonally adjusted. The jump in hiring happened despite surging Omicron cases last month that caused widespread disruptions for businesses and employees. We're taking a closer look at what the numbers tell us about the state of the economic recovery, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you recently started a new job? Have you recently left a job? Or both? Why was now the right time to make that decision, if so? If you're an employer or a business owner, has it been easier to hire workers, or are you still struggling to fill those open spots? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Janelle Marte covers the economy and the Federal Reserve for Reuters. Janelle, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, better than expected is what people are saying about these numbers. First of all, why were expectations for a lower, maybe a gloomier job report last month?
Well, Rob, you already mentioned Omicron, and that was the big factor that was expected to at least put a damper on hiring. And some economists were expecting that we might even have a contraction in the labor market because of what we've been hearing from businesses that have had to cancel events, people having to stay home at times if their child's schools were temporarily closed or their daycare was closed. And the expectation was that this was going to at least slow down hiring. But instead, we saw, like you mentioned, very strong numbers. Businesses kept adding to their staff, and there were fewer layoffs than we typically see at this time of the year.
And it wasn't just January. The numbers for November and December, which had been a little ho-hum, they were revised upwards, so they look pretty good, too. Now, these monthly reports, this is just one indicator. This isn't the whole story. But with those 3 months in mind, what does this say about the job market now?
I think it's showing that we had much steadier job growth over the course of the year last year than we initially thought. And that's just part of how this data works. You know, it's based on surveys and over time, and every year at this time of year, they do revisions with more information. And so what we learned is that the job growth over the course of last year was steadier than we initially anticipated. And this just supports the picture that the labor market is getting stronger and that we are seeing more people get back to work.
There's this other indicator called the labor force participation rate, which means basically, as I understand it, people of working age and the percentage of them that are actually working versus not working for whatever reason or not seeking employment. That's still a little bit lower than it was before the pandemic. It's been inching up. What are you watching for there?
Good point. So this is a metric that economists like to watch closely because it does show what share of the population is working or looking for work. And when we're looking at things like full employment, this concept that anyone who wants a job can get a job, if the labor force participation rate is not quite back to where it was before the pandemic or taking longer to come back, that could be an indication that people are either getting discouraged or for whatever reason not able to get work or feel like they can't work right now. And so I think that's where people are starting to anticipate, well, okay, what is causing that participation rate to recover a little bit more slowly? And there are some economists that say that it's partly because of the pandemic. So I mentioned some of the challenges with childcare being less available in many parts of the country. And we're also seeing an increase in retirement, or rather an increase, or rather it's more of a decrease in people coming back to work from retirement because of the pandemic in part. And so people are watching this number to see the workers who have left the labor force. Will they come back? And maybe can we really say we're near full employment, you know, until that happens? And it's part of the ongoing debate that's happening right now.
We are talking about the latest jobs numbers with Janelle Marte with Reuters. She covers the economy and the Federal Reserve there. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? Did you retire maybe earlier than planned? Are you thinking about coming back to work or not? Did you just get a job, just change jobs, just leave a job? And if you are someone who hires people, what are things like for you right now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Janelle, I just asked people if they're part of what some people have called a great resignation or quitting. You use the phrase in one of your pieces, a great reshuffling, when you look at the labor market. What do you mean by that?
So the great resignation has come about because people are quitting their jobs at near record rates. So last year, an average of 4 million people quit their job every month. And that is staggering. We haven't, you know, this level of quits is not, like I said, it's near record rates. So what's happening, though, is that a lot of people are taking a moment. They're seeing what's going on with the economy. They're seeing that job openings are also near record rates. Last month we had, as of December, there were 10.9 million job openings. So for people who are working, who are able to work, that means that they have more options than they have in the past. So some of this is just related to what economists call cyclical, right? We're at a moment now where the labor market is growing, is improving, companies are hiring. And so for people who have a job or are thinking about doing something different, that presents them with more opportunities, more options, and workers are taking advantage of that. And so that's what we're seeing. I called it a great reshuffling because it's more of people switching jobs. Hires are greater. The number of hires happening every month is greater than the number of people who are quitting. So that would suggest that most people who are quitting are doing so for another job. Hopefully you would think it's for a better job, right? You hear a lot of people talking about flexibility, work from home. They're taking the moment to say, okay, well, hey, there aren't that many people willing to step up right now. They're asking for more money. They're asking for better pay, bonuses. But it's not always people switching for a positive reason. You could imagine that there are also people who are quitting because they have to, because the circumstances related to the pandemic have changed. And so they're stepping away and then coming back when they're able to work again.
I've seen some people make a case that that's part of the story with job numbers not going down during the Omicron surge. Employers saying, yeah, maybe even with this surge, my business is going down right now, but I'm in this desperate competition to hire people. I can't stop hiring people. I'll bank them for the future. Do you think that's part of the story?
That is part of what's going on. So we have seen that businesses, so typically, you know, a lot of businesses will boost their hiring for the holiday season, and then they will let people go around January. What's going on is because of the staffing shortages that a lot of companies are facing, they're holding on to those workers a little bit longer and saying, hey, we got you in, it's going well, why we're going to keep you as long as we can. And so that is also contributing to the stronger employment growth that we saw in January because of technical reasons. You know, the labor market numbers are adjusted. And so if we don't have as many layoffs as usual, then that can boost hiring.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Deb is with us in Appleton. Hi, Deb.
Hi. Good afternoon.
What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I'm recently retired myself, but I have friends who are approaching retirement age or who are at retirement age who were not planning on retiring as soon as they are, you know, this year, last year, next year, but are now planning to retire. And the biggest cause of the fact that they want to now retire early is because of the stress levels that their jobs are causing them. And that's directly related to COVID because of shortage in staffing, because of higher expectations from employers, because of some of those shortages, or because of extended hours that people are having to work. There's just been a lot of stress related to work issues. I'm from the education field myself, and teachers, for one, are stressed because they have kids online and they have kids in the classroom, and they have to make sure that kids are following the rules about all of the COVID protocols, and they have just so much more on their plates than they did. I mean, teachers have always had a lot on their plates, but even than they did, you know, 3 years ago.
Deb, thank you so much for sharing your story and that of your friends, Janelle. A lot of people just feeling more stress, maybe driving them out of a job or out of the workplace.
That's absolutely true. I've looked at this a little bit in, for instance, the childcare industry. So that's an industry where the work is typically low paid and very demanding. So as the caller mentioned, you can have situations where people are saying, hey, I'm not getting paid enough to put up with this stress. And as well, because of the fact that their colleagues might be quitting, then they have to put in longer hours. And it's making it difficult, especially at a time when there are other industries that are better able to increase pay. So you might say, hey, you know, I talked to some people who were seeing offers for jobs that they would consider to be less stressful, maybe not as rewarding if you're someone who's really passionate about that field, like in education, or passionate about childcare. But you could say, hey, I won't have to deal with as much responsibility and I'll be paid more. So what's going on is that some industries are facing increased competition from other industries that they typically are not used to competing with. And it's making it especially hard for them to fill their open positions. And it's toughest on the ones like in again, childcare is a good example where it's difficult to raise pay because of the way that it is, that pay is structured in that industry, meaning that it's based off of what the client, AKA the parent, is willing or able to pay. And so as we all know, childcare is already very expensive in this country. And so there's just this tension here of how can they adjust the structure of the program to make it so that it's, you know, more affordable, but also they can better retain the employees and the high qualified employees that they need. And that this is happening in a lot of different industries to different extents.
Deb, thanks for the call. We're talking to Janelle Marte. She covers the economy and Federal Reserve for Reuters with us today to talk about better than expected hiring numbers in January, plus December and November. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you changed jobs? Are you considering changing jobs? Have you left the workforce, or are you thinking about it? Or are you thinking about coming back into the workforce? Are you hiring people or trying to hire people? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our look at hiring in the United States and why the latest jobs numbers beat expectations. Janelle Marte with Reuters stays with us. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your experiences in the job market as an employee or employer. 800-642 is the number. Sorry, excuse me. 800-642-1234. Need all those numbers in there. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Janelle, I want to get into the other half of your beat. Now, the Federal Reserve, there's concern about inflation, of course, going on with these jobs numbers, too. And some people have said, and I think you may have even mentioned something like this, Janelle, in your work, that hot, good-looking jobs numbers may free the Fed's hands to try to deal with inflation. Can you connect the dots?
So the Federal Reserve has a dual mandate. And so that means that it has a responsibility or a mandate to not only promote job growth and aim for maximum employment, but also to keep prices steady. And so it's a two parts of its mandate that can that sometimes face a little bit of tension in the sense of, well, we're in a moment right now where 2.9 million Americans are still out of work when compared to before the pandemic. But inflation is at the highest level that it's been in about four decades. So the Fed needs to control that, you know, keep a focus on the second part of that mandate now, which is becoming more urgent. So what this jobs report does is it provides more evidence to suggest that the labor market is in a strong place. So the Fed can then continue with its plan, the plan that it's, you know, signaling to markets that it's putting into place of removing some of the support that it provided during the pandemic, right? So its officials have been saying for a few months now that the economy does not need the same kind of support. We're almost now with the 4% unemployment rate, we're approaching the unemployment level seen before the pandemic. And again, with inflation being so high, they definitely want to move toward removing that support to minimize the risk that they could fuel for further price increases and to perhaps even slow demand a little bit so that that can ease off of some of the pressure that is leading to those higher prices.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Tom is with us on his way into Appleton. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up?
My question is that when I retired, we all had to wait till we were 65 to be able to have insurance on Social Security. But now, because other insurance was so expensive or even not available, now with the Affordable Care Act, if I quit my $50,000 a year job at 60 and retire and maybe take a part-time, or maybe I've got some money in my IRA I can take out some of, I can get insurance on the Affordable Care Act. Do we have any data on whether that's a few thousand people or a few million people that are able to do that or are doing that now?
Tom, interesting. I haven't seen anything about that, Janelle. Have you run into that?
I think it's something that I would have to check the numbers on, but certainly you're bringing up a good point, which is that that flexibility to purchase insurance if you're able to get a more affordable plan is probably playing a role. You also have to think about, you know, you mentioned retirement savings. The unique thing, given though, you know, we've had some weakness recently in the stock market, but if you think about it, there's been quite a run up in the stock market during the pandemic. So that's another thing that might be helping people who are in retirement or near retirement age, just to say, okay, my portfolio is doing decently well. I can afford to step back from the labor market or can afford to stay in retirement versus coming back to work.
Tom, thanks a lot for that call. The hope, the case numbers for Omicron seem to be going down pretty steadily. The hospitalization and death numbers, we hope, of course, will follow that. What kind of things are people watching for in the economy as, fingers crossed, Omicron doesn't loom so large?
So we'll be watching for, obviously, you mentioned case numbers. And, you know, there's a lot of high frequency data that economists watch now. And that can include mobility numbers. So that, like, that's taking cell phone data and seeing how, you know, are people moving around, leaving, traveling, doing things like that. We also have some, you know, unemployment claims that are looked at every week, consumer credit card spending data. These are just figures that we can keep an eye on to get a better sense of how the economy is reacting to the virus and to other shifts going on right now.
And I should ask, people are getting hired. People are apparently having the flexibility or willingness to change jobs. Is that reflected in wage numbers? Is this driving up wages on average for American workers?
Well, good point there. The wage growth is definitely a metric that's being kept kept an eye on. You have to consider, because of the high quits rate and the labor shortage, we're seeing wages go up, especially for those jobs in the low end. Think about retail, or in some cases restaurant jobs and things like that, where pay is coming up, and it's even coming up on the high end. I know we've had a few stories recently about some more, you could call tech jobs or professional jobs, where the pay is increasing. We're hearing a lot about that on Wall Street for sure. So definitely wages are coming up, and it's something to keep an eye on. And, you know, there are people wondering, well, how long will that continue? And if we start to see some of these restraints ease over time, will that then kind of cause workers to lose some of the leverage that they've gained? And we'll have to keep an eye on and see.
In just our last 30 seconds, Janelle, what do you have your eye on in particular?
Well, I am going to be watching for more information on how that recovery looks like by gender and race. So we've had some strong gains, but the Black unemployment rate is still much higher than the white unemployment rate, about two times as much. And we're seeing that Black women have had a slower, have more ground to cover. So I'm going to keep an eye on those things to see how the labor market heals from now on.
Janelle, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
That's Janelle Marte. She covers the economy and the Federal Reserve for Reuters. She was with us today to talk about why the January jobs report showed stronger hiring than previously expected. Still time for you to share your story. If you've switched jobs lately, email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us @CentralTimeWPR. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, have you seen a snowy owl this season? We'll check out the cool and unique birds, their visits to Wisconsin, why they vary from year to year, and find out how to get the best chance of getting a glimpse of them. And maybe you can report your own sightings along the way. That's Snowy Owls, tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Valentine's Day is coming up. Are you looking for some Valentine's candy? Do you want to make sure you're getting the same things that everyone else is? If so, you're in luck. The website candystore.com is out with their annual state-by-state map of the most popular Valentine's Day candies based on their sales and other industry info. Here in Wisconsin, number three, Ghirardelli chocolate gift boxes. In second place, Hershey's Kisses. And number one, the Conversation Hearts. You know, those chalky candies with words on them. Looking at our neighbors, Illinois agrees with us on the Conversation Hearts. Iowa has M&Ms in the top spot. And Michigan and Minnesota are big Nirvana fans with a heart-shaped box of chocolates taking the top spot. Candy news you can use. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, when independent pharmacies close, it can have a big impact on their communities. We'll talk to a researcher about how pharmacies in rural areas are doing during the pandemic. Now, new research estimates that 14% of the world's tree species have yet to be discovered. That amounts to over 9,000 types of tree. One of the authors of the paper joins us now for a look at the quest to find those trees. Peter Reich is a professor of forest ecology at the University of Minnesota and director of the Institute for Global Change Biology at the University of Michigan. Peter, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you.
Well, step one here, 73,000 tree species you and your colleagues estimate in this report. How do you start to come up with a number like that?
Well, that's a great question. The way we did it is we built the world's largest database on forests, with more than 40 million trees from more than 90 countries, by building a consortium of scientists who are willing to work together and share their data. So the first thing was putting all that data together And when we did that, we were able to count there are maybe 64,000 tree species we already know about. But then the kind of magical part was like, well, we know we haven't found all the tree species. And so we used some modern novel statistics to estimate the number of trees we have yet to discover from the number of trees that we only found once or twice or three times in our sample, because the ratio of those and some other equations together give us an estimate of how many we haven't yet encountered in any given sample.
So approximately 9,200 kinds of trees may exist on this earth that haven't been discovered and cataloged yet. That seems like a lot.
It does seem like a lot. And I should mention that probably some of those trees were known to indigenous people, but probably not all of them. But there's those 9,200 are not known to Western scientists. And it does seem like a lot, but actually we had two different kind of responses from our co-authors. Some who work in places like Wisconsin or Europe were surprised that there were that many species we had not yet found. But others who work in the tropics, they think we may have more that we haven't yet found because they know how sparsely we've sampled forests in the Amazon and in Africa and in Southeast Asia and other places like that.
Yeah, can you talk more about those ecosystems, especially those tropical ecosystems, where there may be a lot of potentially these rare trees?
Yeah, well, it's the perfect storm of ignorance, if you will, on the part of science, that the place where the diversity is highest in any one location and highest across the landscape or region are the tropics and subtropics in South America, Central America, Mexico, Africa, Southeast Asia, and the like. And those are places where scientists have not gone and sampled very much. So there's a lot of diversity, and we've only sampled some of it. And so those are the places where the greatest amount of known diversity is, but also the greatest amount of unknown diversity. So that's where we could look to find all those other 9,300 species we haven't yet found.
Now, that sounds cool in the sense that we could discover more stuff. It also seems worrisome. We hear places like the Amazon, a lot of impingement on those, destruction of parts of those ecosystems. It's possible that a rare tree could go extinct and we don't even notice it.
Exactly. And that's kind of my next kind of point on why this is important, is that we know we're losing diversity, and diversity helps maintain forests healthy, helps maintain our forests in a healthy and resilient state. But if we don't even know what we have to begin with, how do we know what we've lost? So knowing more about these trees is very important. But you really hit upon the key thing. That to me is it's more important to preserve these than it is to learn their names. And that because so many of these tree species are rare, they're more vulnerable to being lost through things like deforestation and climate change. And so this adds urgency to the already urgent task we have of trying to conserve and preserve tropical forests and subtropical forests in every continent where we find them.
Talking to Peter Reich, professor of forest ecology at the University of Minnesota, director of the Institute for Global Change Biology at the University of Michigan, about a new paper he was involved in saying there may well be over 9,000 species of trees on this planet Earth, as yet unidentified by science. Peter, what kind of efforts are there out there in the scientific world to find and describe these trees?
Well, it seems like perhaps there should be lots of resources in that direction, but it's actually very hard to find money to go ahead and try to sample forests in these remote places where there are often no roads and it's hard to get around. So there are scientists who are very, very actively doing this and devoting much of their time to it, but it's not generally a high priority from scientific agencies. And so it's really through grassroots efforts of scientists who go out and sample maybe 30 different forests, in a country in Africa or Southeast Asia. And then what we were able to do is bring these people together. The scientists, we often don't have incentives to come and work together. We brought everyone together to share their data and together be able to tell a more complete story than any of us could do alone. And hopefully this kind of work will now spur some more action and hopefully some more resources to try to study these forests more in the future and also to act to preserve and conserve them.
And Peter, you mentioned many of these species may be known to indigenous people in, say, these tropical regions. Is there an effort to, cooperate, do citizen science with the locals who may have discovered this this particular tree species hundreds of years ago?
There for sure are efforts like that going on an ad hoc basis. We have not tried to do that with our network by any means yet, but it's a great idea, and it would be fabulous really try to push that forward as much as possible and do it in a coordinated way.
Now, you and I are both based here in the Midwest. Odds are we're not going to go in our backyard and stumble across one of these as yet unidentified trees, right?
Absolutely. The likelihood of there being an undiscovered tree species in the U.S. mainland or Canada is pretty darn low. But if we just go across the Caribbean or the border into Mexico, there are lots of islands in the tropics and subtropics, Central and South America and in the Caribbean, where there very well might be undiscovered trees.
In just our last minute or so, is there a concern that climate change might be putting these, again, as yet uncatalogued trees at risk in their potentially vulnerable ecosystems?
Yes, and that's to really work both to slow and stop climate change and to preserve forests, is that to date, land use change, things like deforestation, have been the biggest impact on tree diversity and all kinds of diversity in the tropics. But we anticipate in this century that climate change will be become equally or larger in terms of its impact, because climate change is literally changing conditions right out from underneath these trees. And the rare trees have a very narrow set of conditions in which they can thrive in the first place. And now if it's getting warmer and or drier or warmer and drier, they're going to have a tough time. So we need to give them all the help we can by working to slow and stop climate change and slow and stop as much deforestation as we can.
We'll leave it there, Peter. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for your interest.
Peter Rice is a professor of forest ecology at the University of Minnesota and director of the Institute for Global Change Biology at the University of Michigan. He talked to us about a paper he co-authored showing that about 14% of tree species in the world have yet to be cataloged by science. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Producer Mary Kate McCoy brings us a story about a conservationist helping farmers make the transition to managed grazing.
When it comes to successful conservation, working well with people can be more important than the science. One conservationist in southern Wisconsin is working to help farmers make the transition to managed grazing, a more environmentally and often financially stable farming practice. This story comes to you from the Grassland 2.0 Project podcast. Here's host Jacob Grace.
Serge Koenig has served Sauk County, Wisconsin for nearly 30 years as a county conservationist. He's seen numerous changes throughout his career, including in his own thinking about conservation. In the past year, Serge has helped transition hundreds of Sauk County acres to managed rotational grazing, a farming practice that is more economically stable for farmers and is often described as the gold standard for soil and water conservation. But Serge's journey to conservation began on the other side of the world during his childhood in Madagascar.
Growing up in Madagascar, we spent time in the woods and in the field all the time. We basically lived outside, and when I came to the U.S., it was a natural fit for me to go dive into something that I felt a strong connection to. This was the first job out of college that I got, and I've stayed here. It's been just such a good fit for me. Early on in my career, I was somewhat interested in rotational grazing, but we had a big toolbox that we picked from, and it was just a small tool. These practices were making some difference, but they weren't making the transformative differences that we needed to make.
As Serge spent more time on Wisconsin farms, he became impressed with how well managed grazing worked not just as a conservation practice, but as a profitable business for farmers.
When you look at all the soil health principles, well, managed grazing checks all of them and then some. And so it just made sense to go right to that. When I run the numbers with producers, it's awfully viable, and you don't have to gross this much when your expenses are this low. And so at the end of the day, it's about what did you get to keep? And so that's a mindset that we're hoping to change. I know when we first started having pasture walks here, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, we'd get 10 people maybe. And lately we've been getting close to 50 people.
Serge believes that the growing interest in managed grazing is not just due to its conservation benefits, but because many Wisconsin farms are actively seeking alternatives after dealing with years of economic hardship.
That's all part of the picture. It isn't just conservation. It's the people on the landscape that really drive the system. The job isn't really about conservation. It's really about working through the people stuff. It just always is. No matter how you slice it, it's always working through the people stuff. And when we approach it that way, just things work better. We don't talk about water quality. We just talk about quality of life, goals, grazing as an alternative, but like what you want, and talk about the finances, and all this other stuff just comes along for the ride. If we don't get that right, it doesn't matter how logical it seems on paper or even on the spreadsheet, it doesn't matter. That's why it has to be coupled with like life stuff. It has to be, and we have to be comfortable talking about that. And yep, you're gonna get yelled at a few times. Yep, it's not gonna be pleasant, and I've had all those things. But like, again, if you're driven in here, if that drive is there and you know your why, that's what we want to help our producers figure out. Why are you doing this? You better know yours, because you know it's not always smooth for you either. But like, if you know your why, it's so much easier to help others figure out what their why is.
This story was brought to you by the Grassland 2.0 Project, which seeks to transform Midwest agriculture through the use of grassland farming systems. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Coming up, we'll hear what a tough time for independent pharmacies can mean for rural communities here in the Midwest. That's next on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, analysis from University of Iowa's Rural Policy Research Institute shows that over 1,000 of the nation's independent rural pharmacies closed during a recent 15-year period. And the COVID-19 pandemic added more challenges for these small pharmacies. Those closures have created drugstore deserts in hundreds of small communities. Keith Mueller is director of the Rural Policy Research Institute and researches how rural areas get their health care. He recently talked to WPR host Lee Rayburn.
Keith Mueller, as we mentioned at the top of the segment, your research indicates over 1,000 independent rural pharmacies have shuttered their doors between 2003 and 2018. Just how serious has this decline been?
Well, I guess, Lee, it depends on where you live. I mean, for those of us who live in an area, I happen to live in a suburban area, so if a store closes, an independent pharmacy near me closes, it's not a major thing. But, you know, our interest being a rural research center is we're looking at smaller rural communities, and if the independent closes, that's it. And there's no chain immediately available. And so the difficulty becomes one of obtaining medications that are not long-term medications for chronic illnesses. You can get those through mail order services, but if you need something shorter term, getting that in a timely manner, getting the consultation that you like to have with a pharmacist about reviewing the medication you're taking and or helping you understand the importance of the doses and making sure you take just one pill, or if you have to cut it in half, that you're doing that, and the pharmacist can monitor that because they know how often you're refilling. And just that relationship, the pharmacist is another healthcare provider. And we know that those relationships with our providers, particularly the ones that are dealing with our primary conditions, are critical. And so when we start losing that in rural places because of the closure of the independent pharmacy, which was the one that was able to, for a long time, serve a community, that becomes a real issue.
Keith Mueller is the director of the Rural Policy Research Institute at the University of Iowa. He also studies the delivery of health care in rural areas. And the issue sounds like a public health concern in rural areas across the country, Keith, in a time when we're looking at public health concerns with the pandemic. And you alluded to it earlier, but would you expand a little more on how the COVID-19 pandemic is affecting rural pharmacies?
Well, and I'll start my answer, Lee, with a takeoff from what you were saying about the importance of pharmacy. And when you hit a time of pandemic, one of the projects we did with our database of where all the pharmacies are was help a lot of different states around the country understand where they had pharmacies that had experience administering vaccines or other medications so that they became outlets for administering vaccines in the first rollout. We need those kind of outlets, and local rural pharmacies can provide those. I mean, there were national contracts signed with big chains around the country, but they don't reach all of those rural places. And so that's one of the reasons, again, we think the local pharmacy is so important. And what happens during something like a pandemic where it changes how people use services for at least some period of time because you don't get out as much, or you try to avoid going into to crowded places, or you just slow down in what you're doing, that affects any kind of retail business, including the local retail pharmacy. So on the one hand, they're an important outlet for things like the vaccine. On the other hand, they're also subject to, you know, a dramatic shift in demand for their services and demand for the other products that they're selling in the store that help them keep the store open, including the pharmacy.
Are there challenges? Are these just challenges of a free market? Are we dealing with the effects of supply and demand, or is it something else at play here?
Well, there are challenges in a way of the free market. What they're telling us in part is if you rely entirely on the free market and the exchange of goods for prices, there are places where the market doesn't quite work because you don't have the right level of demand that would attract the retail business into that particular community. And in those kinds of situations, we need to figure out alternatives and or ways that we can help a local service provider stay there. And I worded that generally because it's not just pharmacies that are prey to that. We're talking about them today. So it's an example of the challenges of making, if you rely on the free market as the way of getting goods to people and services to people, well, it may make a lot of sense where you can have competing entities to do that, and you have a lot, and you have customers that are attractive to businesses. If you get into more remote rural communities, those sort of preconditions for how the market could really function well do not exist. And so we need to be aware of that, which is our job as researchers.
So with your work in mind then at the Rural Policy Research Institute at the University of Iowa, as you see it, Keith, what's it going to take to reverse some of these trends and ensure communities can keep getting prescriptions and other vital health care?
A combination of a financial model that can work in a lot of places where the old one has failed us in a sense. And that may mean dealing with, in the prescription drug end of it, dealing with where the dollars flow. I mean, one of the things we found in that second spike I was talking about is the issue related to pharmacy benefit managers who are sort of middle organizations between the wholesaler or the manufacturer and the wholesaler and the retailer. And there seems to be, you know, a need to address how to streamline some of that and take some of that cost out of the system, and that may help bring the shelf price or the price of putting it on the shelf down for the pharmacy. I think that's one approach is how do we try to set up an economic model that works. The other is thinking about the service delivery model. And, you know, if it doesn't work to have a high-trained pharmacist in a lot of places, what we call the PharmD trained person, Does it work to use, and the answer I think is yes, we're seeing around the country, to use telepharmacy services with a technician locally that can fill the prescription. So it's a less level of training, therefore lower cost, professional locally. But through the use of telehealth, you can bring that service to the community, including the ability to consult with the PharmD pharmacist who doesn't have to be there for that consultation to happen. So that's the combination that I see as how to get through this.
Keith, thank you for sharing your work with us today.
My pleasure.
That was Rural Policy Research Institute Director Keith Mueller talking to WPR host Lee Rayburn. They talked about the problems that rural communities face when independent pharmacies close down. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the pandemic will end someday, but COVID probably isn't going to go away completely. We'll find out what it will mean when it becomes an endemic disease instead of a pandemic disease. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.